Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and I want to extend a warm welcome to everyone who's joining us here on Happy Hour with Dr. T. Tuesday is guest day for us on Happy Hour, and it's where we invite special guests, Christian authors, Christian businessmen and businesswomen, pastors, to join us to share their wisdom, talk about their books if they've got them in line, and also to lead us in prayer. All of our podcasts are aired every single day now at 11 a.m. and replayed at 7 p.m. on the same podcast, on the same channels that you've always watched us at, on Telegram, on Cloud Hub, on Rumble, and on X, and a whole bunch of different places. So you can find us there, and they're always posted there. They do not go away, particularly on Cloud Hub. You can watch, you don't have to, if you miss it, you can go back and watch it later. Which reminds me to remind you that we've got a new podcast membership that we've started. It's called Tenpenny Prime, and that way there you'll get three special things just for podcast members to the Tenpenny Prime membership each month, and then all the podcasts will be now freely available. We'll still host them in your portal so that they're easy for you to find. So before I introduce, and to find out more information about that, go to drtenpenny.com, drtenpenny.com, hover over the membership tab, and there'll be a thing that will drop down, will tell you everything you need to know about our new Tenpenny Prime membership. So before I introduce to you today's special guest, Leslie Corbley, the author of Silent Suffering, Poems on Pain and Purpose, we're going to take a really short break. You don't want to miss this. This is really interesting and not really in the line of a lot of things that we talk about. So I think you'll really want to cue in and hear what we're going to have to say. We'll be right back.
Zeolite is a detox spray. We work specifically with a company called Touchstone Essentials. They are an incredible company. We've been working with them now for several years. And zeolite is a mineral that goes through your body like a one-way basket. It will clean out heavy metals such as arsenic and mercury, aluminum, cadmium, and it hooks onto those metals from a one-way perspective. So once it's bound, it goes out through your urine or your stools and doesn't get redeposited in other places. Everybody needs to have a detox product in their life, and this one is so easy to use, and it's so safe. You can take it when you're pregnant. You can take it when you're nursing. You can give it to little children. You can even give it to infants, and quite frankly, I give it to my dog. I actually put a little bit of the zeolite in his water because until we all stop living in a toxic world, we all need to get some of those extra toxicities out, the heavy metals, the persistent organic pollutants, the things that are floating through the air, the different things that we come in touch with in our environment. And we are a big fan of zeolite from Touchstone Essentials. We've been a big, big, big fan of their products for several years.
Go to drtenpenny.com/detox to get your first bottle of zeolite spray for $50 off. Well, welcome back, everyone. Leslie Corbley is a poet, author, and an attorney. She is a dynamic voice in the reality of poetry, law, and cultural commentary. In her debut book, Silent Suffering, Poems of Pain and Purpose, she masterfully critiques progressive ideologies while at the same time shedding light on the quiet struggles and suffering of modern nonconformists. Leslie's unique perspective blends the analytical rigor of her legal background with the timeless artistry of classical poetry, inviting readers to rediscover faith, hope, and humanity amidst a fractured cultural landscape. She holds a BA in journalism and a JD degree from the University of Oklahoma College of Law. She writes broadly on cultural topics ranging from civil liberties to philosophy, theology, classical wisdom, and human dignity. She lives in Utah with her husband, Tim, and when she's not writing, she can be found hiking, playing the piano, or diving deep into philosophical debates on history and theology. This is going to be a great conversation, Leslie. Thank you so much for joining us, and welcome to Happy Hour with Dr. T.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to chat about the book.
Yeah, I'm really interested in learning how you got into writing poetry. And like I said before we went live, it just seems like writing poetry and being a lawyer are kind of diametrically opposed.
I know. That's what it would seem like, right? So I never, honestly, if you'd even told me 2 to 3 years ago that I would have been writing poetry, I'm not sure I would have believed it. I grew up in a very mathematical home. So my parents both have masters of math, and I was homeschooled with my 6 older siblings
Oh,
until I
wow.
went to college. So my background did not lend itself to anything poetic. I had to read poetry, of course, for literature, and I enjoyed it, but most poetry that I consumed was even in the classical vein. So for me, classical was always a whole different beast than like free verse contemporary poetry, which I really struggled to connect with at all. But classical poetry is still heavily focused on the senses. And I've always focused more on, the senses of the mind rather than the 5 senses of the body. And so, long story short, a couple of years ago, when this journey sort of started, I was thinking about kind of, okay, how do you begin to inject more viewpoint diversity into certain cultural spaces, right? Like there's this idea, particularly in the artistic realm, that's so heavily dominated by left-wing thought. And I think that that's a real shame because it's really important for for there to be a broad range of ideas represented in the artistic realm. And so I think that that viewpoint, the homogeneous nature of the viewpoint in the arts, is also reflected in the mediums used to connect with with the public, to connect the ideas with the public, right? So you don't see a lot, you mostly see free verse as opposed to classical form, which moves away from any kind of structure as you're communicating your ideas. And so I thought, I've always been good at writing. I've always loved writing. I've always loved reading. I've always been an avid reader. So I thought, well, you know what? You could probably write poetry. I can't sing, for instance. Like, there's no way I could like get in front of a microphone and sing. And so I started writing poems and just going to local like coffee shops and bars in the Salt Lake City metro area near where I live, and performing them, just as just a fun thing to do, and kind of a way to bring, like I said, different ideas to the community around me. And so that's kind of how it started.
Well, you brought up an interesting point that I don't think that many people know about, and it would be good to for you to explain with your background in journalism that there is a structured way and styles to poetry. I mean, poetry isn't anything that I've spent a lot of time in, and so please educate me because this is very interesting.
Sure. So, I mean, the poetry I would have read more growing up would have been in the classical genre. So, focusing on meter, rhyme, and specific stylistic choices of that nature to structure the idea such that as you're writing it, you're bringing a certain rhythm and structure to your reader or listener. So, my poetry, I wouldn't say stays in the strict confines of classical poetry. For example, it doesn't use long and short syllables in the kind of really more rigid manner that you might see in classical style. However, I did stick with meter and rhyme as a way to kind of rhythmically connect the ideas in an almost more musical way. And I did that intentionally because I think it helps the reader and listener to connect more to your ideas if there's some form of structure. As opposed to what looks to me to be more disjointed prose style poetry that dominates the contemporary landscape right now. That's what, for instance, always made it hard for me to connect with contemporary poetry, was that it was so void of structure that it was just difficult for me to engage with that medium.
So it sounds to me again, like I'm a poetry novice. I probably the last poetry I read was probably in high school, to be honest with you. And so it sounds like, and with your background in journalism, like you really intentionally design the poetry that you're talking about instead of it kind of like free flowing and like you said, the rhymey sort of thing, that you really intentionally have to pick the words to say exactly what you mean. That's very fascinating.
Yes, absolutely. Because I really was trying to convey the ideas, again, in a poetic format. And it was important to me to convey them both poetically, but also to infuse them with what I view to be truth and beauty, right? Like these sort of aspects of humanity that transcend time period, right? I wanted these ideas that are ancient and, in my view, true and good to be injected into the poetry in a way that would sort of show how, I mean, the title of the poetry collection, The Silent Suffering, so show sort of the ways in which we're sort of oppressed in the modern era, maybe in ways that we don't understand, right? So I really did want to inject that into the poetry as well. I wanted it to be very ideas focused and for the listener or reader to be able to go back to the poem and almost like glean more reflective material as they continue to re-engage with the work.
That's kind of what the people that wrote the testimonials for your book, you know, the back cover and things, mm-hmm. that's kind of the way they gave accolades to your book about how that really was, your poems were really reflective. What was your driving force to write that type of poetry?
So this type of poetry, I would say it really was sparked by probably the 7 years I spent in higher education, which is a very progressive landscape, a very progressive culture. And there's certain ideas and cultural attitudes that those who are progressive sort of have. And one of them is that they're tolerant and kind and compassionate, right? They kind of view themselves as being, for lack of a better phrase, morally superior. And there's a lot of critique that goes on in university settings of religious cultures and traditional cultures and the problems that can arise with individuals who fall on the margin of those subcultures in America. I say subcultures because I think it's difficult to argue America is truly religious at this point. That being said, I found it very fascinating that there was no real corresponding critique of what the margins of progressive culture looks like who falls at the margin of a progressive culture wasn't really something that seemed to be on the minds of those academics, which in my view seemed a little bit almost like it took a narrow-minded approach to the definition of words like compassion or hatred, right? These almost had textbook definitions where they had sort of almost a formula where they would assume that that certain groups were always oppressors and others always oppressed. And that sort of flies in the face of history, in my view, because I think history is pretty clear, makes it pretty clear that, you know, all humans are capable of being both perpetrators of harm and, you know, simultaneously victims of harm. So there's not this like clear, you know, bucket in which you can put groups that perpetrate harm and then those who experience oppression. And so this was sort of, I really wanted to bring to the public some of the ways in which progressive culture can itself be stifling and oppressive, because I just don't think that that's often explored in really in-depth formats. I think the public is sensing it right now. You can see that in our politics, but it's often not given a lot of long-form attention.
So what would you define as the fringes of liberal academia or liberal thinking, or what would you call on the fringes? Are those people that are out of the center core and are almost turning conservative? Is that what you would call them?
I mean, there's certainly that aspect for sure. I mean, you see the kind of I would say the obvious individuals who would fall on the margins would be, you know, the most obvious would be the cis white heterosexual male. Right. Right. Like that's kind of the obvious sort of boogeyman that the progressive routinely decries. Right. And kind of wants to push out of power. But at a more philosophical and fundamental level, I would actually say it's children.
Oh, wow. And dive into that a little bit.
Yeah. So I think the reason I would say that is that I think the most common form of child abuse in this country is actually abortion, because that's, you know, that's clearly, you know, it harms a lot of children, it kills a lot of children. But there's this tendency, I think, to bifurcate the harms of abortion and think of most of the harm as being perpetrated against the baby that's killed. And that's, of course, makes sense, right? Like that's the direct victim of abortion. But the indirect victim would be, in my view, all children, right? Because once you take abortion and you make it and you elevate it to a human right, what you're essentially saying is that women have a sex-based right to determine who lives and dies, which was once a power we culturally, I mean, regardless of what religion you followed, was really essentially assigned to God. So you're elevating, you're actually saying women are morally superior because you're saying that they have the just authority to determine who lives and dies. Like that's what you're saying with that claim. And so that fundamentally alters the child mother-child relationship from a symbiotic sacred relationship to a power dynamic.
Wow.
And that tells children implicitly that they are of less value than their mother. So it implicitly tells them that they are not equal. They gain equality by becoming adults. Like they gain equality by virtue of the value their mother assigned them. And I think that that has a lot of fundamental philosophical implications that we just don't know how to really explore, partially because children can't consent and because the mother-child bond is still very strong in spite of that, right? Because it's a physiological and nature-driven bond. But yeah, I think it essentially tells children that they have less value than their mothers.
Wow, that's a really profound way of looking at it. I mean, that's really deep. And I would, listening to your explanation, I would tend to agree with you. You know, a lot of people in my age group, you know, they talk about when they were younger, their mom used to say things like, "I brought you in, I'm going to take you out. I can take you out," you know, and they said that in funning and maybe when they were really angry, like they didn't clean their room or, you know, something happened. But in a larger perspective, that's really true. I mean, there's some really truth to that when you bind that in with the abortion issue.
Yes, and look at how, for example, how so Democrats and those on the left are generally individuals who talk a lot about like cultural genocide, or they'll talk about things like trans genocide, which is essentially, I mean, it's not an actual genocide, but a concept to me, from what I can gather, seems to be that that seeking to have a society that in some way maybe says that there are men and women, and that transgenderism is in some way a mental, you know, disorder of some type, is seeking to make it to where transgender individuals can't really exist in society, right? That seems to be the overarching concept that they're driving at. And what I find fascinating is that there's a literal group of people, it's increasing in size, but a quite literal group of people that the Democratic Party wishes didn't exist. So this group has always existed in some form, but it's now increasingly quantifiable. And what I'm referring to are Dobbs babies. So trigger laws that went into effect across the nation after.
What are Dobbs babies?
After the Dobbs decision that overturned Roe v. Wade, a whole host of states had trigger laws that went into effect. And approximately a year later, researchers had already determined there were something approximating 30,000 additional births that resulted because these clinics were closed, and so women could not access abortions as quickly. And so this group of people is again quantifiable and growing, because you know, it's not like these trigger laws went into effect and they're not going back to allowing abortion in those states. So there's a whole cohort of children whose births were quite literally mourned. And I find that fascinating.
Wow.
You know, I mean, you're the party that talks a lot about dehumanizing.
Who's doing the mourning? Who's mourning them?
Oh, I mean, those on the left, I mean, there were articles written, you know, about these trigger laws and how, you know, this is a...
All of these babies were born and they wish they were...
I mean, essentially, yes. It's saying this was an assault on women's reproductive rights, and look at what this horrible result is. And well, the result is people were born. So, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, what you're saying is that these children are a result of a human rights violation. So imagine if you're the child and you're a Dobbs baby.
Seriously.
And you're being told that your existence is the result of a human rights violation. So again, I find this fascinating because there's such a heavy critique of certain religious concepts, for example, original sin, and the Christian religion is heavily critiqued by seculars. And yet here is this concept that is sort of staring you in the face in relation to abortion. And there seems to be no corresponding critique of what that would do to the dignity of the children who are on the receiving end of being told that their existence is a mistake.
And you said there's about 30,000 of them?
I mean, that figure's old. So I want to say that was maybe a year or so after Dobbs. I'm trying to remember the exact date that research came out, but I mean, that's growing, right? So I mean, again, clinics that closed in Texas haven't reopened, for example. And while some women will go out of state to obtain an abortion or will seek to have, pills, abortion pills, maybe illegally transported to states that ban abortion, the reality is that, you know, if you put barriers to access to obtaining a medical procedure, and in this case, one that's deadly, or, you know, chemical pills that can terminate preborn life, you're going to end up with more births in certain circumstances. So, you know, it's a growing cohort.
These Dobbs babies, you've got my mind just sort of like Velcroed on that concept now, that they are actually, I mean, they've got to be a couple of years old now, and mm-hmm. they are been told since they were born that you shouldn't be here, and you're here by a mistake. What kind of actual trauma is that going to induce on those children?
Well, I mean, I'm sure we'll induce a lot of trauma on them. I mean, hopefully, you know, obviously with that large of a number, you're going to have some women, for example, who didn't obtain an abortion and probably are going to bond just fine with their children. And, you know, it'll almost be like no harm, no foul in a way, right? Like they'll probably bond well with their children, and maybe the children won't even ever know, you know, for some of them that was a situation they were in because it would have been prior to their birth. That being said, there's undoubtedly going to be some children that are aware of this. And for what it's worth, this is a problem that existed prior to Dobbs. It's just that Dobbs makes it quantifiable into a known class, right? So for example, you hear, whenever you hear someone on the left complaining about, oh my gosh, you shouldn't be pressuring a woman not to have an abortion. That's an example, right? Like if the woman chooses not to abort in spite of being pressured to, that's a possible story that someone learns down the line as to so-and-so didn't want me to be born, right? So family members who pressure other family members to abort. Or, there's also the Abortion Survivors Network, which is run by a woman who survived a failed abortion attempt. These stories have existed for some time. They're very much dismissed and kept in the dark because, again, they're very powerful reminders of what's actually occurring in society by elevating abortion to a human right. And to be clear, what I'm critiquing here is specifically claiming it's a human right. Because while I'm pro-life and very much anti-abortion, the distinct claim that abortion is a human right is very different than saying abortion shouldn't be heavily like criminalized or something, right? Like these are different claims. When you say something's a human right, that comes with a much more powerful connotation. You're saying that essentially that any attempt to infringe on this is a violation of dignity. So you're saying that, again, any attempt to protect the unborn, if this is a human right, is an infringement on a woman's dignity. So this is, in my view, claiming a woman, that women as a class have some elevated sense of morality, because birth control is, in my view, what levels the playing field as it relates to reproduction between men and women. But, obviously birth control is designed more or less to stop conception, not to kill, preborn children. And so once you tell women that they have the, you know, essentially a right to a sex-based right to violence, I think you're making an entirely different philosophical claim at that point.
And are those stories in that philosophical position, which is very well thought out and very well articulated, were those stories what sort of moved into your book on silent suffering and of pain and purpose? Was that sort of, were there some parts of your book that were driven by that concept?
Absolutely. So there's a poem in the collection titled Compassion or Cruelty, and that is specifically addressing the Dobbs baby question, right? So it takes a hypothetical story of a girl who was a Dobbs baby, and it walks the listener and reader through her experience growing up, sort of having this mark of shame that befalls her. It's almost like a scarlet letter on her name, and it walks through the story of her knowing she's a Dobbs baby and really being very wary of disclosing that, say, to friends or to others, because it brings this internal sense of shame. And she's aware, of course, that the culture around her is very pro-abortion, right? And in school and elsewhere, you know, these the kind of places that are are generally governed by progressive forms of, you know, morality and justice, are going to tell her, you know, they're telling her in no uncertain terms that absolutely your birth was a mistake. You should not be here. You know, you have the stain. You're birthed from a human rights violation. You know, that's not a particularly pleasant thing to hear if you're a child.
Yeah, I just, you know, I'm just thinking this through while I'm listening to you talk about that. What would it feel like from the time you're in, because kids are so mean and, you know, school is so hard anyways, and it's so much harder now than when I was young and growing up. And I thought it was hard. It was nothing compared to what kids go through now, to go through having, saying that you're a mistake and you shouldn't be here. Wow.
Well, think of even the implications beyond. I mean, think of what abortion in that way. And then, of course, there's amplifying all of that with social media, which is what kids are navigating now, which is, you know, a whole different host of problems. But it's not difficult to hop on social media and look up some, and just see the discourse surrounding abortion and surrounding the unborn. I mean, you know, there are, and I'm not saying this is common, but it's by no means something that's difficult to find on the internet. Individuals who will throw parties to celebrate their abortions with cakes that will say it's aborted or, you know, something like that to kind of, and again, I'm not saying this is common, but even if what is being done is to some degree mocking or in jest, it just goes to show the callousness with which you can speak of children. You can't speak of, imagine if any other demographic in this country were spoken of in that manner, you know, it would be deemed horrifically inappropriate. And yet you can kind of talk about children as if they're burdens, as if they're, you know, you can just devalue them in ways that you really can't talk about other demographics that way. Maybe white men, you know, you can maybe degrade them in such a manner. But when you think about children, again, you can't punch up at a child, right? I mean, you're kind of by definition punching down when you're attacking, you know, children. And you can claim that you don't think that they're children. I mean, there's the biology and science is pretty clear on that matter as to it being the children being human beings in the earliest stages of development. But again, I think it just goes to show what, when taken to its logical conclusion, what abortion as a human right really means. It really means that you're reordering a mother-child relationship and you're essentially turning it, like I said, into a power dynamic, and to some degree, you're turning children into property.
Ooh, wow, that's and that makes them be non-existent, and goes in with the 325,000 missing children in this country and the trafficking sort of thing, and maybe that's part of, because I've tried to get my head around the fact of why, who would do that, and why would you want to do that? And if you look at that as not as a little human being, but as a property and something that disposable, it's, you can see where people who think like that would contribute to that.
I know, it's fascinating because I'm really interested in exploring other themes of culture in subsequent poetic work. So again, I have a nonfiction book that's coming out, and, you know, I've really enjoyed writing the poetry. So there's all kinds of other themes that I want to tease out poetically, partially because I think poetry is such a fantastic medium to explore topics that have been undiscussed, because it's a very good medium to initially name phenomenons that are largely undefined, right? Because you don't have the kind of strict analytic confines that you might in other forms of the written word. So with poetry, you're able to kind of almost delve into a deeper aspect of the human condition, I think, than you can in other formats. So I'm really interested in delving into some of these other ideas. But just, you know, for your listeners, I think it's really important to connect the concept, like I said, of looking at abortion as telling children they're unequal. And I think that makes it a lot easier to understand the ways in which motherhood is devalued, and the ways in which, frankly, there's a lot of rhetoric surrounding pregnancy and postpartum that is very rooted in fear-mongering. And I think that that's connected, again, to this idea of really disconnecting the mother and child and turning it into this, almost as if they're warring with one another. This idea that they're at war rather than actually having a symbiotic interconnected relationship, which is what, you know, is occurring in utero and frankly out of utero, particularly in the very early days of the child's birth.
You know, it's you explore really interesting things, even in the book that you have just published, that your collection is divided into several sections of yearnings, infinite complexity, oppression, and hope. How did those four sections come about?
Sure. So I saw those as sort of like completing a circle that kind of is a complete representation of the human experience. So when you're born and as you're becoming more conscious and aware of both who you are, the world, you're asking really important questions about maybe God and reality. You have certain yearnings, right? You yearn for love. You yearn to feel connected to others. You yearn for peace, for example. You have all these sort of innate human yearnings that everyone really experiences. And so that then, I believe, moves from yearning into everyone grapples at some level with the infinite complexity of the world around them, right? They grapple with the reality that you're going to have to move through the world without absolute certainty as to what you believe being true. You're going to have to continue as you learn more to integrate that into the map of knowledge you have in your mind that orients you towards whatever purpose it is that you believe you have in life. And that infinite complexity, the reason it moves into then the titled section that's titled oppression, sort of that's designed to grapple with the oppression of our present moment, right? And that like oppression is present in every era of history, right? There's no era of history that has no form of oppression. So the fact that it's progressive oppression, in my view, in this era, you know, and in an era before and after will look different, but that's designed to really highlight what the margins of society look like in our present era. Because again, so much of the analysis of what marginalization looks like borrows from the past and sort of like projects that onto the present moment, right? We have these prejudices of the past that progressives speak of as being emergent today. And that has some degree of truth. It's not like past prejudices just go away and have no long-term effect. But that being said, the whole 20th century occurred, and that was primarily dominated by progressive thought. And so there's all kinds of prejudices and oppression that, you know, that come from that. And so again, that's where the human dignity and sort of the rights of children are dissected and clarified in poetic format. And then that moves into, from oppression, it moves into hope, which takes you almost back to yearning, except it's a more fleshed out and mature version of yearnings in a way, right? It's that we all yearn. Ultimately, what do we yearn for? We yearn for hope. We yearn for the belief that there, or the reality that there is something beyond the pain we experience in the present.
Wow. That is a full circle. That's a, and you're right. That's very logically thought out. I can see in your writing, your lawyeredness coming through. So we're gonna. That's a good spot to take a really quick break. Today we're talking with Leslie Corbley and her book that just came out. It's called Silent Suffering: Poems of Pain and Purpose. We've got more to come. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
There are an awful lot of people that are affiliates for Mike Lindell because we all really appreciate what he does for this country. We appreciate the hard work that he does, and we appreciate his products. He has more than 200 products in his store, everything from pillowcases and comforters to doggy beds and to wonderful slippers and bathrobes. There's something for everybody and something for everybody in each age group. I mean, one of the things that I really like a lot are the pillowcases, the children's Bible story pillowcases that I just think are such a great way when you tuck your child into bed at night to use these pillowcases that they come from his store to start to tell the story about Adam and Eve and Noah and the Ark and different things. And they're colorful and they're really pretty. So from children all the way up to your gentlemen that want to have like nice slippers or to your dog, the doggy beds and things are just wonderful. So my pillow is a great place to shop for just about anything that you want. And if you use our affiliate code DRT, that helps us, that can benefit us, that helps Mike Lindell, and you'll get a great product for anybody that you're shopping for.
Well, welcome back, everyone. Well, Leslie, this is just so fascinating and such a different type of discussion that we generally have. And it's just a brings a lot of fruitiness. And I meant that with all due respect about your lawyerness, because it's a logical progression. And journalism tends to be logical. And then lawyerism is logical on top of that. And on the back cover of your book, your endorsements say, "For those who can't define harm, fail to see abuse." I just thought that was really profound. Can you expand on that thinking for a bit?
Sure. So that line actually is from the poem I mentioned earlier called Compassion or Cruelty, that kind of fleshes out what the experience of a baby born as a result of the closure of an abortion clinic, like what would her experience in progressive culture be? And yeah, I think that that's the quintessential, frankly, example of female perpetrated abuse. And I think female perpetrated abuse is one of the most difficult forms of harm to identify in society, because it is so wrapped up in caretaking. Like, it's very wrapped up in compassion and care, and it is very hard to identify the line between compassion, care, and control when you're in intimate relationships. That's, of course, what makes domestic violence, for example, so difficult notoriously to identify. It's also what makes it really hard to identify when female caretakers are abusing children.
Yeah, I want to read that again just for the listeners, because it was really, really a good sentence. For those who can't define harm, fail to see abuse. It's sort of like the Supreme Court definition of what is pornography. And they say, well, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it, you know. And so, but if you can't define the harm, you're not going to see the abuse. I think that's very, very profound, very profound.
Yes, and it's occurring in, I think, a lot of facets of society. What I find fascinating is, I think it, from what I can tell, it seems to be occurring primarily in relation to roles in society that involve caretaking. So there seems to be, again, abortion, I think, is a common example of people claim it's not causing any harm. There's no harm, no foul. You know, it's not a person yet. Personhood hasn't occurred until after the baby's born, so this isn't harm. Again, I don't think you can easily bifurcate children into in utero and out of utero. They all came from utero, right? We all know this. So there's that issue. But there's also the issue, I think, that's increasingly salient to the public of, frankly, the ease with which medical professionals whose duty is to first do no harm often stray from that. Right. I mean, I think particularly in the wake of the COVID pandemic, you're seeing a lot of people really question those who claim to have their best interests at heart. So the concept of compassion, I think, is becoming, in the public's mind, it's becoming a concept that's easy to mock and easy to view with cynicism.
Yeah. And, you know, and then you weave in the elements of like trust and respect, and are you being respected as a patient? And are you,
yes,
are you not? There are a whole bunch of different layers of elements of that I think came out of COVID that are exposing things that maybe we haven't seen before, or we have chosen to ignore before. Which do you think it is?
I think it's probably a bit of both. I think it's a failure to see it. But I think that failure to see it is also because when you're in a high trust society, it's easy to ignore. And some of these problems can almost have like a creeping effect. You know, they tend to snowball. And that's how I think ideological capture, particularly of systems, like bureaucratic systems, work. You know, bureaucracies have almost like a mind of their own, and certainly an incentive structure that each individual is encouraged to act according to the incentives of that bureaucratic system. So yeah, I think it tends to snowball over time. There's a reason that it seems that more and more people are moving towards alternate health, you know, strategies to manage their healthcare, because it is increasingly difficult to, I think, find competent healthcare that's rooted in really important and frankly important principles that undergird, you know, from a legal perspective, are, you know, concepts like informed consent that are the basis of the dignity that individuals have when interfacing with medical professionals, right? This idea that you're entitled to informed consent and to make your own decisions as a patient, rather, you know, than being kind of having those decisions dictatorially thrust upon you by medical professionals.
which seems to be less and less these days in terms of informed consent, or the information that you get kind of coerces you into consent rather than giving you pros and cons and from a neutral position and then answering questions and then allowing you to decide. The information coerces you into that sort of consent. Are you still, what area of law did you study when you went to law school?
So in law school, I've always, I've most of my work has been in look at the intersection of law and policy and some journalism as well, although that was a little earlier in my career. I practiced consumer debt or bankruptcy right out of law school and then transitioned after the COVID pandemic to handling a portfolio of privacy legislation. And that's what brought me out to Utah. So I was working with a local think tank to deal with legislative issues related to digital privacy and individual rights. So I've worked on that. I've worked on free speech on college campuses. And yeah, I've extended my licensure to several jurisdictions this year and will be, you know, working with a couple of firms moving forward. So that will be really good.
Firms. So you're actively practicing law now?
I am. Yes. I did unfortunately have to sit for the uniform. So I sat for the bar exam in 2019 in Oklahoma, which is my home jurisdiction. But I didn't practice long enough in Oklahoma to have my licensure automatically be able to be waived into other jurisdictions. So I took the uniform bar exam last July to extend my licensure to relevant jurisdictions, including Utah. So I'm working with a firm in Arizona as well, and we'll be engaging in private practice here in Utah soon.
Well, that's kind of interesting to me because I know a lot of lawyers and I have a lot of lawyer friends. So there is now a bar exam, or an exam that you can take that allows you to be licensed in multiple states?
Yes, I think
for the bar in each individual state?
Yes. So most states have the uniform bar exam. Oklahoma, I think, transitioned to accepting what's called it's the UBE for short, but they now accept the UBE. They didn't when I graduated law school. It was still an individual state test, but each state sets their own score for an acceptable passing score. So I passed with a score high enough to practice in any jurisdiction that accepts the uniform bar exam. So that's most jurisdictions in the U.S. I think California is one that doesn't. Like Louisiana, I don't think accepts the UBE either, but most jurisdictions do. So you just have to go through what's called the character and fitness review process, which is frankly the most frustrating part because it takes, you know, it just takes a while to get through for them to complete the investigation. But it's at that point primarily just a matter of once you sit for the bar and get the score you need to, it's just a matter of time, you know, for them to process your application.
You know, I don't think they do, but it would be great to have something like that in healthcare and in dentistry. Yeah. I mean, dentistry is really even more rigid, at least it used to be. And since I'm not seeing patients right now, and I don't have any real affiliation with any medical schools, I don't think that they've changed that. But I think even like the application process, I mean, when you have to go through an application process in a state, I mean, your name, your date of birth, where you went to school, graduation, it doesn't change. It doesn't matter if you were 20 or if you're 60. It's the same. They couldn't kind of unify that. That's just great. Well, hopping back to your book here for a bit, you know, listeners who are not familiar with poetry or read poetry, walk us through the best way to appreciate your work and how to best read it.
Sure. So I would recommend just reading it. I want to get an audio version of the book out as well, because I think that will help readers to, I think listening to poetry is very valuable as well. But for what it's worth, one of the things that I thought was really neat when I read the poems in public formats is that it really did seem to connect with people who generally wrote poetry off as a medium of communication that they didn't understand or have any interest in engaging with. So if for listeners that are kind of going, oh man, I haven't read poetry in forever, or I've never read poetry at all, this might be something that's a little different than what you typically sort of conceive of when you approach poetry. And I think one of the things that does make it distinct is it is quite a bit more analytical and focused more on, so it combines philosophy, theology, and history. Again, so focusing more on stimulus of the mind rather than the five senses, which is what a lot of poetry focuses on, right? Your sight, your smell, your taste, your touch. And it doesn't really engage as much with that and is much more internal and reflective.
You know, when I invite guests on to our happy hour show, which we've been doing now for 4 years. So we've been doing this every Tuesday. At first, we were doing it 5 nights a week, and now we do it twice a week. But on my Tuesday night show, I always ask the guests that come on, it doesn't really matter what we talk about, but I ask them to bring a verse from the Bible that means something to them. And which in the verse that you picked out is probably one of the more controversial verses in the Bible, I think. And so I really would like you to, and you are so analytical and you explain things really well. So I'd really like to have your take on this. And for the listeners, I will read it. You know, Luke 14, verse 26. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And I think that that's one of the, I mean, there are a list of verses that I've kind of collected, and we're going to do some summary podcast things on them. But I think that that's one of the more controversial ones. At least it's on my list. So I would really like for you to discuss this and go into it a little bit because of the way that you express things from an analytical perspective. I really want to hear what you have to say.
Sure. So, interestingly enough, I have that verse and a couple of others tattooed on my arms. And it's an ode actually to, I don't know if you're familiar with Dietrich Bonhoeffer, but there is a poem that commemorates Bonhoeffer in the collection. And I think Bonhoeffer would be, if I were to pinpoint an influence that led me to Christ, it would be Bonhoeffer above all else. And the reason for that is the way in which he framed the cost of discipleship. So that verse, Luke 14, 26, is the verse that I begin in a lot of Bibles. If you were to pick up, I think an ESV Bible, for example, it would be the verse that comes right after the heading, the cost of discipleship. So it's obviously hyperbole to some degree to make a point. It's not saying you literally hate your family members, but the idea being that your love for Christ is supreme. And if, you know, you don't put any earthly attachment above that commitment that you make to Christ. And so again, kind of connecting the individual with what it is to pursue goodness, right? Like Christ is the embodiment of truth and goodness. So you are to pursue that over and above any other earthly commitment that you may make, whether that's to your spouse, to your family. You know, these are commitments that in the Bible, you know, are good. These are good relationships. You should cultivate them. But at the end of the day, to the extent that they conflict with pursuit of Christ and pursuit of truth and goodness and beauty, you abandon them, you know, it in favor of picking up the cross and following Christ.
That's beautiful. That's really good. Good.
So it is very intense, but it's, you know, I think that's important to remember, you know, that does, there are unfortunately circumstances where you have to choose between family and what is good. And
yeah,
you should choose what's
a lot
good.
Of people, a lot of us experience that, a lot of people, not myself, but a lot of people experience that during COVID. You know, and how that caused such divisiveness with families. And, you know, are you going to stand up and say, no, I'm not going to be injected with that, you know, experimental product. I'm just not going to do it. And then, you know, the ostracization that came from families and your job and communities and things like that for standing on your principles. And I think that those, you know, standing on those principles, we're going to be tested more and more with that as to,
yes,
time goes on. So I think that's really, really good. So now you got me going. I'm really curious. What are the other verses on your arm that you have?
Oh, sure. Okay. So the verses, so this is Luke 14, 26, and this is Matthew 10, 34. This is a really simple one. It says, I come not to bring peace, but a sword. So I'm a really happy person. You can tell. Anyway. And then this tattoo says, all I have is Christ in a circle. So the three tattoos combined are actually my interpretation of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's thesis statement in his seminal work, The Cost of Discipleship. So the concept being the left arm represents the cost, the prices. It's not going to always be, you know, you've counted the cost. It demands your life. You know, I come not bring peace, but a sword, as a reminder that the truth inherently involves conflict. You know, the truth does not always, and it's not always sitting in a circle and having a fun consensus with people around you. You know, at times you're going to have to be willing to raise the sword of truth, right? So that's what that verse brings to mind for me. And then all I have is Christ in a circle to represent eternity and also to remind me of the reward, right? You've counted the cost and you're saying, I'm pursuing truth, goodness, and this is embodied in the divinity of Christ. That's what I follow, right? That's who I am. That is what I pursue. And that's the reason that this cost is worth the price.
Wow.
Because that's what refines you. It turns you into a better person. It sanctifies you. As you continue to walk down this, journey of life, you're walking towards something that's worthy of the sacrifice you're making.
Well, I can't wait to dig into your book. Usually, I guess your book just recently came out, didn't it?
It came out. I can't believe it's been almost, March of last year, I think, is when it dropped. So it's been out for a little bit, but it's my debut poetry collection. Poetry is a difficult, it's a difficult medium, I think, in a way, in the sense of it's considered maybe almost esoteric and, particularly something a little more analytical. It's not what most people think of when they think of poetry. So I'm really hoping that it will reach an audience that maybe, again, generally doesn't think poetry is for them, because I think it connects with the mind more. And with, I think a lot of people are in that space too, of maybe wanting to reflect on culture, where we are, and the role of the individual in our social setting.
So the book is Silent Suffering, Poems of Pain and Purpose. And where can they find that book? And do you have a website and a writing place where people can follow more of your really incredible thought processes here? It's really great.
Absolutely. So LeslieCorbley.com is my website. There's a link to all my socials there, including a Substack. I'm hopefully going to be posting more. I need to be posting more poems soon. My first son is now 5 months old. So I know it's been such a blessing to have him. But at any rate, yes, LeslieCorbley.com is where you can find that. I'll be posting more poems that aren't actually in the collection. So the poems on Substack are not to be found in the current collection. There are additional, poetic thoughts I have that are connected to some cultural commentary as well. And then, of course, if you go over to Amazon.com, you can type in the book name or my name, and it will pop up with a copy. So it's available online, pretty much at any book retailer.
Okay. And so for the people who've popped in here late, I'm going to say it again. This is Leslie Corbley, Silent Suffering, Poems of Pain and Purpose. Well, Leslie, this has been just a wonderful conversation with you. And thank you for sharing your in-depth insights. It's been really, really, really great to listen to you. And I want to thank everybody who joins us here every week at Happy Hour with Dr. T. Again, this will be aired again tonight at 7 o'clock if you missed it, or if you want to listen to it again, because that was kind of like drinking from a fire hose, I think, of all the incredible information that you gave out. So people may want to listen to it again at 7 o'clock, and then you can search it and find it again with Forward Going. So I want to say a special thank you for anybody that's a Tenpenny Prime member that's joining us here. And I want to close out my podcast with one of my favorite verses from the Bible. I close all my podcasts with, whether it's live or pre-recorded, which is Romans 12:12. Rejoice in hope, be patient in trouble, and be persistent in prayer. So until we meet again on the next time, stay close to God, trust him. He will never let you down. Leslie, thank you so much for being a delightful guest here with us tonight. And to everyone else, have a great week. And we'll see you here back here, same place, same time next week. It's now 11 a.m. every Tuesday. So have a great week, everybody. Good night, goodbye, and God bless.
In a time when truth is censored, one name stands out. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, the relentless seeker of knowledge and defender of freedom. Explore groundbreaking findings at drtenpenny.com. Ignite your mind with riveting podcasts, explosive articles, research-driven substacks, webinars, ebooks, and more. In an era plagued by environmental toxins and vaccine-related exposures, Dr. Tenpenny has expertly crafted a selection of safe detox protocols that facilitate profound healing at a cellular level. It's time to cleanse, rejuvenate, and restore your body's vitality. With heart damage on the rise, Dr. Tenpenny introduces nationwide ECP therapy to repair hearts and achieve optimal health.
Seize the opportunity and embrace the wealth of resources, information, and health recommendations awaiting you at drtenpenny.com and become a Tenpenny podcast member to join our mission in the quest for uncensored truth, the health of our nation, and medical freedom.